From WNYC in New York, this is NPR's On the Media. I'm Brooke Gladstone.
And I'm Bob Garfield. And here is our president.
My personal opinion is it was a shameful act for someone to disclose this very important program in time of war. The fact that we're discussing this program is helping the enemy.
That shameful act was the New York Times story on the National Security Agency's secret domestic wiretapping program in 2005. Words like shameful, unconscionable, treasonous often are applied to investigative reporting, usually by embarrassed politicians. Publishers, on the other hand, may be more inclined towards words like exorbitant or extravagant or just plain unaffordable, because investigative pieces can consume years of labor and mountains of cash, not including legal fees, an investment few newspapers can afford to make.
We're devoting this hour to investigative reporting, which has blossomed and faded and bloomed again across the decades. Veteran investigative reporter Lowell Bergman says it thrives best in a particular political and regulatory climate. That's why the 1970s provided perfect weather for investigative work.
It wasn't until the confluence of the Vietnam War and the civil rights movement and the turmoil that became Watergate that in-depth investigative reporting was unleashed in major market newspapers like the New York Times. The other part of what went on during this period of time is that the FCC in the broadcasting area set certain standards, like the right of reply, fairness, and one very particular one, which is they declared that 7 o'clock on Sundays was a protected time period. And it just so happened that CBS had a fledgling magazine program called 60 Minutes. It became a huge hit because nobody could run anything against it other than other public interest broadcasting. And the public interest was basically defined as what the public needed to know. That public interest standard, which still is in the law, is now defined as what the public wants to know. The result is the whole definition of news in broadcasting was transformed in the 1980s, and by the time you got into the 1990s, you had a race to the bottom.
Bergman has investigated stories both for print and broadcast. The film The Insider was based on his tobacco industry investigation for 60 Minutes. He says that once upon a time that ended almost 20 years ago, newspapers made lots of money, money enough to flow to all those pricey investigations. But he says those days are gone. Now those stories are the province of just a handful of elite outlets.
Go look at your Pulitzer Prizes, and you'll see that there are more and more Pulitzer Prizes being won by fewer and fewer newspapers. So the result is what you see at a place, let's say, like the Los Angeles Times, where there are big cutbacks going on and where the future has been written large on the wall by the new owner.
And they're still winning award after award.
But their reporters are fleeing to places like ProPublica, this new nonprofit organization, because they can see where the future, well, there is no future where they are.
Do you think you could report the big stories that you've reported in your career now?
I'm not a good example. I can have a lot of opportunities that younger people don't necessarily have. You'll see when you go around the country and talk to graduates, let's say, of this journalism school and reporters in general, they're getting fewer and fewer resources, less and less airtime or less and less space in the newspaper to get into subjects in depth, to really cover them. We're not talking about stenography here, which is a certain kind of reporting that goes on all the time. We're talking about having the resources to get deeply into what's really going on. Back 40 or 50 years ago, some of us did it for nothing. Remember that when Cy Hirsch did the My Lai story, which is a Pulitzer Prize-winning story about massacres in Vietnam, he had to go to the only existing nonprofit organization at the time, the Fund for Investigative Journalism, and get a grant to cover his expenses. It's the same place I went to in those days.
So, it sounds like it's the same thing all over again.
Yeah, it was deja vu all over again in many ways. Technological change is going on just like it was 40 years ago. The difference today is that the economy and the model for producing journalism is going south as opposed to going north.
Lowell Bergman is a professor at UC Berkeley's Graduate School of Journalism and a consultant to the investigative journalism nonprofit ProPublica.
As Bergman mentioned, ProPublica has become a sanctuary for orphaned investigative reporters. Its executive editor, Paul Steiger, former managing editor of The Wall Street Journal, will preside over an envy-inducing budget of $10 million annually for the first 3 years. ProPublica recently partnered with our producing station, WNYC, on an investigation into safety concerns surrounding natural gas drilling in New York. Steve Engelberg is the managing editor of ProPublica, and he joins us. Steve, welcome.
Thanks very much.
When we think of investigative reporting, we often think of the New York Times, the Washington Post, the Wall Street Journal. Have they evinced any interest in this new model of cooperation with a nonprofit?
I think everybody at the major newspapers has a kind of theoretical interest in this, but they have a balancing act, and we understand that. They have a very still hardworking large staff at each of those places. And in terms of dealing with an outside organization, they are setting rightly a high bar, which is to say we should be bringing in something of extraordinary nature.
I want to ask you about the S word, S standing for Sandler, the benefactors of ProPublica. They have a history of affiliation with progressive political causes. What is the firewall that ProPublica has between them and their political ideology and the kind of reporting you do?
Well, number one, the board of ProPublica, which is chaired by Herb Sandler, has formally said that it will not and does not want to be notified about ongoing journalistic efforts. So there is a kind of formal wall between the Sandlers and what we're doing. But it goes well beyond that. I think the Sandlers understand that if we are viewed as the tool of one political party or another, it almost entirely destroys our ability to report on both sides of an issue.
I understand what you're saying, but I also understand PR. You have many potential stories. Maybe a story comes in that could be embarrassing to the political left. Would your management team lean towards it, as opposed to one that might embarrass someone on the political right, for the purpose of establishing your own independence?
Well, I personally wouldn't. And I think once you go down that slippery slope of making editorial decisions on the basis of what you think your image is going to be, I think you've kind of lost your footing as a journalist.
Let me ask you one more thing. I think obviously the opportunities for a group like ProPublica and other nonprofits is extremely bright. But that's substantially because the world of newspapers is in such a shambles. Isn't there something just heartbreaking about this whole environment?
What is heartbreaking is, in part, and understandably, you necessarily feel that the difficulties the enterprise is in, on some level, reflects the quality of the journalism. And I think there is some truth in that. It's not a total coincidence that people sort of aged 28 to 45 are dropping off in readership. So I'm not saying we're not in some way responsible. But in large measure, what we have here is a broken business model, and we have the effect of a recession piled upon the effect of losing all that classified ad revenue. And that, in general, is not the journalist's fault. And yet, if you work in a news organization today, you feel terrible.
I appreciate your time. Thanks an awful lot.
My pleasure. Thanks, Bob.
Steve Engelberg is the managing editor of ProPublica.
If nonprofits are one model for the future of investigative journalism, the potential fundraising, audience-directing, wisdom of crowds power offered by the web is another. As newspaper circulation sinks, the number of people logging on to newspaper websites rises. Jeff Jarvis, director of the Interactive Journalism Program at the City University of New York, says the web also is home to a new kind of reporting.
The classic example is Josh Marshall's Talking Points memo. And Arianna Huffington says of him that while big media has ADD and can't ever stay on a story, he has OCD and he dogs the story till it's done. So that's really his value, is that even if he doesn't report it, and he often does, he also keeps big media on the story. And it's a great new pressure. But we're also seeing something new online, which is the ability to collaborate. Porkbusters did a great job of getting bloggers of all stripes. It's really a bipartisan, with libertarians, tripartisan group. And there was a secret hold on a bill in the Senate that was going to open up data online. Well, it's secret. So what Porkbusters did, they said, hey, folks, call up your senator's office, find out whether or not they are the hold. And they asked senator after senator after senator, and they ticked them off one by one. They got down to three and found out there were two senators who had the hold. They were outed. The hold was taken off. The bill passed. So it's a combination then of crowdsourced reporting and advocacy, which is another interesting trend here.
Well, let's talk about advocacy then, because we try and draw a clear line in mainstream old-style reporting between advocating for a position and reporting it. That distinction is blurry, non-existent, irrelevant perhaps online?
It's always been blurry in mainstream media, because when you decide we're going to go after the bastards, that is a position of advocacy. You've decided they're bastards, and you're going to get them. Well, that's been true in big media all the time. There's a victim and there's a victimizer. And you're taking a side when you do investigative journalism most times. Online, I think what we have is a little more transparency. We could admit that I'm a part of this group and I've got an axe to grind, but even so, I have found the facts to prove that the bozo is a bozo.
And there's an ethos to reporting online. This sense of competition doesn't seem to exist there.
Online is about connections and collaboration. Bloggers rely on the resource that mainstream media puts into this, but they also can collaborate. They can help push the story. They can help add facts to the story. They can do lots of things. The important ethical issue online is that we've got to support journalism at its source. When the Washington Post did this great story about the Walter Reed Army Medical Center, other newspapers, the old way, would have replicated that story. But what we should do in the new way is send all of our traffic to the Post and let them monetize that, let them support that journalism.
And obviously, traffic to a newspaper website translates into revenue.
Exactly. And it's their job to monetize that. The actual dollars that are spent on investigative journalism in America are not as great as we think. If you look at a metro market and say, how much is actually being spent today on investigative journalism? I believe that could be supplemented by ProPublica, by foundations, and by individuals. A bright young guy named David Cohn has started something called Spot.us, where individuals will be able to donate to get a journalist to do a story. Is that going to support whole newspapers? No. But could it support a journalist doing a story? Yes. So I think we have new opportunities to support investigative journalism in new ways online. The whole business is still in trouble, and investigative journalism is in peril. But I think that if we put the attention on this crisis, I think that we'll realize how important it is to support investigative journalism in the new ways we can.
Jeff, thanks so much.
Thanks.
Jeff Jarvis is director of the Interactive Journalism Program at the City University of New York.
This is On the Media from NPR.
This is On the Media, devoted this week to investigative journalism. I'm Brooke Gladstone.
And I'm Bob Garfield. In 2005, the war in Iraq was raging. The Bush White House was still managing one of the most secretive on-message administrations in recent memory, and the press was soul-searching about its complicity in the run-up to war. But that climate was beginning to change. In 2004, the Abu Ghraib scandal broke. Detainees at Guantanamo Bay were getting renewed attention as their numbers swelled. And then in 2005, Dana Priest, an investigative and defense reporter at the Washington Post, broke the story of what the intelligence community called black sites. What Priest revealed was an extensive network of secret prisons used for so-called high-value detainees and operated in conjunction with foreign governments we'd previously spurned. The piece caused shock throughout the U.S. and Europe, spurred on further reporting about extraordinary rendition, basically kidnapping, and other extra-legal techniques, all of this initially denied by the Bush administration. Dana Priest joins us now to talk about her reporting. Dana, welcome back to the show.
Glad to be here.
What started you on this story? What was the first tip to you that the U.S. had this extra legal system for terror suspects?
Actually, it went back all the way to December of 2002 when we wrote our very first story saying that U.S. forces capturing people in Afghanistan were holding some of them not in the regular prisons that the military controlled. That got me thinking, well, what are they doing with the Al-Qaeda suspects? And we also talked about the types of methods that they were using, stress and duress techniques. The story that I wrote for the Post in November of 2005 was a culmination of 3 years of reporting about counterterrorism operations.
Well, a stunning culmination it was, but, you know, I must say, for all its detail, it didn't have photographs, it didn't have on-the-record confirmations from administration officials At any point before November 2005, did you personally feel that you had met the threshold for going to publication with this?
You know, you said official confirmation. It had no names of anybody. And even the sources that were helping, you couldn't describe them in any way. I mean, it wasn't a problem to me because I knew who the sources were and I knew how credible they were. But I could see as a reader, you might say, well, why should we believe this? And that's where anyone who's going to write about intelligence has this problem because of the type of sources that you are using and also that you are now in a realm of national security secrets and you have to weigh things that you didn't have to weigh before.
Now, Dana, the Washington Post does not just run a story like this and let the chips fall where they may. It approaches the administration and says, here's what we've got. What have you got to say about it? Can you tell me something about that process?
Yes, we go to the administration with the facts that we have assembled in our story, saying, if you think something we're going to write is going to actually damage national security, now is your time to let us know. And on this story, they did. They said, we don't think you should publish the names of the countries, and we'd really like it if you didn't publish the story. But there wasn't a demand not to publish the story. And then that starts a dialogue. We want to know from them what their reasons are. And they shared some things with us. And then Len Downey, executive editor, had discussions with me and my other editors. And then he made the decision on his own to withhold the names of the countries where they were, but not the region.
I have to ask you about this vetting process. Understanding that the Post has no wish to jeopardize national security, how do you weigh their objections to a story, you know, not knowing whether the boy is just crying wolf?
Intimidation is not a reason to not publish something, nor is political embarrassment. The reasons that we didn't publish the names, as we cited in the story, were basically two arguments they made. One is that because the prisons held high-value detainees, those countries might be more subject to retaliation by al-Qaeda and their affiliates. But secondly, and I think what was more interesting to think about was the potential damage to the relationship between those countries and the CIA in areas of cooperation that were not controversial like the black sites. And we happen to know some of those areas, and therefore we could make a more educated call.
And what about that intervening year when the Bush administration was denying the scenario entirely?
They never actually denied the reports in any public forum. I don't know what they told other journalists. The administration, the Justice Department, and the CIA launched leak investigations. Shortly after I published the Black Site story, the New York Times published their NSA wiretapping story. So all three of us, Eric Lichtblau, Jim Risen, and myself, we were all lumped together when the leader of the House and the Senate demanded an investigation, not of the stories or the black sites, but of the reporting. When a year later the president did end up confirming that they existed and that they were being emptied, I have to say I was shocked. I never thought I would see that day.
Now, you began the investigation that led to the black site story in 2002. It spent several years working on it. Your story runs, you win the Pulitzer Prize, the scales fall from America's eyes about what is being done in the name of national security. And then about 5 minutes later, the newspaper industry just begins to collapse. And the Washington Post right in the middle of that process. If you started your work today, would you have the time, the luxury, and the resources to chip away over the course of 3 years the way you did?
Well, I really do think that I would, and this is why. It's our franchise. Not everybody can do it. And so if you're interested in that as a reader, you will know that you only have a handful of places to turn to look for it. So my editors have continued to give me a lot of freedom. After the Black Site stories, I spent 5 months with another colleague on the national staff working on the Walter Reed Medical Center scandal. And then after that, I
spent another Pulitzer.
No, I've had three potential stories fall apart on me in the last month, but I'm still here, you know, trying to find a new one.
Well, Godspeed to you. Dana, thank you.
Thank you.
Dana Priest writes about national security and intelligence as a staff writer for The Washington Post.
This year marks the 40th anniversary of another historic scoop. On March 16, 1968, U.S. soldiers entered the South Vietnamese village of My Lai and killed hundreds of unarmed civilians in what became the most notorious atrocity of that war. Lieutenant William Calley Jr., a platoon leader in Charlie Company, was court-martialed and charged with murder. In March of this year, reporter Seymour Hirsch told us how he broke the story of My Lai. It began with a tip he received from an anti-war attorney about a soldier who shot up a bunch of civilians in Vietnam. At the Pentagon, he floated that story by a general working for the Army Chief of Staff, and the general mentioned William Calley. Armed now with a name, Hirsch tracked down Calley's lawyer, George Latimer, in Utah. And there, in Latimer's office, Hirsch laid eyes on an Army indictment sheet charging Calley with the murder of, quote, 109 Oriental human beings.
By the way, as soon as I saw that document, I'd like to tell you, I thought, oh, my God, this is going to kill the war. It's going to hurt the war effort. But really, fame, fortune, glory raced through my mind. What a story.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, this is a great story. That gave me the big start. And I figured out where Calley was. I spent a horrible long day looking for him, finally found him.
You didn't know where he was.
Oh, my God, I didn't know anything. I just knew the charge sheet was written at an Army base in South Carolina. And I just started looking for him. I flew that night from the West Coast via Chicago, I think, into Columbia, South Carolina, rented a car, went to the base, and at that time they were open. I was waved in. I parked my car. There was a main headquarters. It was a 30, 40-mile complex. And initially I went to every prison. There were four or five prisons. And I would just drive into the front, and I had my ratty old suit on and a tie and a briefcase and a rental car. I'd get out, and there would be some sergeant, and I'd say, "Sergeant, bring Calley out."
You were posing as a lawyer.
I didn't say. If anybody asked me, I always said I was a reporter. But if they made that assumption, that's fine. And, of course, Calley wasn't in any of these bases, and I'm driving from one camp to another, and I went back to the main headquarters, and I was sort of stuck. And then I remembered when I worked in the Pentagon as a correspondent, the phone books are changed every 3 months.
Mm-hmm.
Calley had come back, according to the lawyer, in August. When he came back, he hadn't been charged. He was under investigation. He was just a guy coming back. So I called up the information office of the base telephone service. I got the chief operator, and I asked her to check the last wave of new listings in August before the new book was published in September. And it took a long time, but they finally found a William L. Calley Jr. that was listed at an engineering base 20 miles away, another one of these large Army facilities. And I raced over to that base, and I ran around from one floor to another and couldn't see anybody. Finally, in the corner of one of the floors was a kid sleeping on a bunk, top bunk. And I thought, this must be Calley. And I remember kicking the bunk and waking up this blonde kid. And I said, "Wake up." And I said, "Calley." He said, "Who?" And he was sitting there, this very young 19-year-old, 20-year-old kid sitting there confused. And because we are nosy, I said, "What are you doing here at 3 o'clock in the afternoon?" And he said, I sort the mail." And I said, "Did you ever hear of a William Calley?" And he looked at me and said, "You mean the guy that shot up everybody?" And eventually, he took me to another facility where there was the senior enlisted man in charge of the mail was there. And then they told me where he was. He was living, get this, the one place nobody would look for him, in the senior bachelor officer's quarters. We're talking about a place with a tennis court and a swimming pool. The last place you'd think, particularly somebody who'd been in the Army like me, a potentially criminal murder first lieutenant would be stashed, but he was stashed there. So I started walking through each room, knocking on doors, saying, "Hey, Bill Calley." I spent maybe 3 or 4 hours doing that with no luck. I left. It was dark by now, 9, 10 o'clock, and there was a guy working on his car. And I went to that guy, and he was a warrant officer, and I said, "Calley?" And he pulled himself out from under the motor, and he looked at me, and he said, "You're looking for William Calley?" And I said, "Yeah." He said, "He lives below me." And Calley was on a boat that day. He'd gone boating. When he came in to the barracks, I was waiting for him. And I said, "Are you Calley? I'm Hirsch." He said, "Oh, yeah. My lawyer said you'd look me up as if I found him so easily." This is 12, 13 hours of looking. And then he told me his story and pretended to be very cocky and calm. But at one point, it must have been 4 or 5 in the morning, we were drinking beer, and he went to the bathroom, and he left the door open and had a mirror in it. And I saw he vomited bright red arterial blood, which I knew then he had an ulcer probably as big as a quarter or a half dollar. And it was a pose.
Not only did you speak to Callie, but you spoke to other people who were at the scene who were very candid about what happened.
After I'd done the first story, I ran into this wonderful soldier. He's now dead, Ronald Ridenour. There's a prize now given in his honor every year. Ronald Ridenour was a soldier who learned about this right away and tried to get something done through the system without any success. And he gave me a company roster. And I began to find the kids. What happened is they had been in the country, this company, Charlie Company, for about 10 or 11 weeks. And they all had been told you're going to be fighting North Vietnamese regular army. They saw nobody. They were a 100-guy strong company. They lost maybe 15 or 20 guys to snipers and bombs. And they were very angry, and they were beginning to take it out on the population. They were told March 15th, tomorrow morning, you're going to meet the enemy for once. And they did what that army did then. They toked up with their joints, and the enlisted men and officers drank. But they got up at 3:30 to kill and be killed. You got to give them their due. They jumped on choppers. They go to this village. They march in looking scared to death, thinking they're going to be in a firefight. There's 500 people sitting around making breakfast, all women, old men, and children. No young men of fighting age. They gather them in three ditches. Callie orders his young men to start shooting. One was Paul Milo, and he shot and shot and shot. When they were all done, they sat along the ditch and had their lunch. Don't ask me how, why. And they heard a keening. And one of the mothers in the bottom of the ditch had tucked a boy underneath, a 2 or 3 year old boy, and he climbed up out of the bodies full of everybody else's blood and began to run in a panic. Callie said to Milo, Paul Milo, this kid from southern Indiana, plug him. Milo, one-on-one, couldn't do it, although he'd fired maybe 10 clips of 20 bullets each into the ditch. So Callie, with great daring do, took his carbine, ran behind the kid and shot him in the back of the head. Everybody remembered that. The next morning, Milo, they're on patrol. Milo gets his leg blown off to the knee. And they call in a helicopter to take him out. And while he's waiting, he starts issuing an oath, a real oath, a chant. God has punished me, Lieutenant Callie, and God is going to punish you. God has punished me. And the kids, when they finally began to tell me about it, and I didn't learn about this for 2 weeks, although everybody knew the story. When the one told me, they all told me. So I hear this story. He lives in southern Indiana. I just dial away. And I call every exchange in Indiana, finally New Goshen, Indiana, which is below Terre Haute, which is below Indianapolis, which is below Chicago. That's where he lives. I fly to Chicago, go to Terre Haute, get a car, go to New Goshen, spend hours. It's a chicken farm. Milo's back. It's a year and a half after the incident. He was shot. He's home now on this farm. Run down, chickens all over the place, a shack house. This mother walks out. I introduce myself, my ratty suit again. I said I was a reporter. I wanted to talk to him. I knew what happened. She said, well, he's in there. She said, I don't know if he'll talk to you. And then this woman, this old southern uneducated woman, she said to me, I gave them a good boy and they sent me back a murderer. I go see the kid. And the first thing I do is I spend 20 minutes talking about his leg. And then I said, what happened? He said, I just began to kill people.
Another enormous story you broke much more recently was the prisoner abuses at Abu Ghraib. And some have drawn parallels between My Lai and Abu Ghraib. Do you think it's fair?
Yes and no. They weren't killing people. But I've talked to a lot of young officers, company commanders and platoon leaders, you know, first and second lieutenants. And the one thing you have in common is they couldn't stand their job because 95% of them was keeping kids from doing terrible things to the civilian population of Iraq. If you don't see the enemy and you're losing people to the landmines, the rage toward the civilian population has got to be immense. And I was on a NPR show, and a woman calls in and said, I had a child in the unit.
At Abu Ghraib.
Yep. I gave her my phone number over the air. And she called a couple of days later. I go to see her, and she had a child come back, completely changed, was completely withdrawn. At some point, the woman who called me took the computer that the child had brought back and began to go through it. And she hit a button, and out came 80 photographs. And the one that the New Yorker published was the iconic photograph of the naked man in front of bars, hands behind his head, two Belgian shepherds snarling at his feet. Well, in the sequence that this woman, this mother saw, the dog attacked the man in a sensitive spot, blood all over.
So that was how you got those pictures?
Probably at that point, at the height of the Abu Ghraib crisis, this is the second week, could she have gotten $100,000 from a network for these pictures? Probably more. She just gave it. 6 months later, I took her to dinner. I was giving a speech somewhere in the area, and she told me the following story. What she hadn't told me earlier is when the child came back, she moved out of the house, left her husband, left the family. Every weekend, she began to get tattoos, dark tattoos. Every time they saw her, more and more tattoos. Eventually, she filled up her body up to the neck with dark tattoos. And the woman said to me at one point, it was as if she had wanted to change her skin.
So there's the comparison. I'm just wondering, though, isn't remembering history supposed to prevent us from repeating it?
Are you suggesting that the American leadership learns from the past? I don't think there's much evidence for that. As we had hell to pay after Vietnam, we're going to have hell to pay among our own soldier population from this war. And that does not even begin to deal with the catastrophe that we've visited on Iraq and the Iraqi society and the Iraqi children who are now in the fifth, sixth year of this utter madness they've been growing up in, this psychotic madness. And what do we owe them?
Cy, thank you very much.
Goodbye, kiddo.
Seymour Hersh is the national security correspondent for The New Yorker.
This is On the Media from NPR.
Support for NPR comes from the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation, committed to building a more just, verdant, and peaceful world. More information at macfound.org. The John S. and James L. Knight Foundation, helping NPR advance journalistic excellence in the digital age. And the Wallace Foundation, whose Knowledge Center is where education leaders can go to learn about improving teaching and learning. Downloads at wallacefoundation.org. This is NPR.
This is On the Media. I'm Brooke Gladstone.
And I'm Bob Garfield. For about 20 years now, Jackson Clarion Ledger reporter Jerry Mitchell has been, to quote one of the people he sent to prison, stirring things up. Mitchell reinvestigates old civil rights era cases and advocates for those cases to be retried. His stories, interviews, and research have helped send four members of the Ku Klux Klan to prison years after law enforcement stopped investigating their crimes. We originally spoke with Mitchell last year, but we wanted to catch up with him because he's made some good progress in his investigation of the so-called Mississippi Burning incident, which involved the murder of three civil rights activists, James Chaney, Andrew Goodman, and Michael Schirner, in Mississippi in June of 1964.
I managed to get a hold of the entire FBI case file, which is rather voluminous, nearly 40,000 pages. And I also have the entire state of Mississippi investigative file. And so basically, I've been going through those documents. What I've found so far is three potential new witnesses against Billy Wayne Posey, one of the five suspects that are still living in that case. Initially, authorities didn't go and talk with these people, but now my understanding is authorities are now trying to go and talk with these potential new witnesses and taking another look at the case.
Now, Jerry, I know spy agencies and investigative reporters are loath to reveal sources and methods, but this began with you got a hold of the entire 40,000-page FBI file on the case. Would you care to share with me how in the world you pulled that off?
Well, yeah, I didn't file a FOIA. I didn't file a Freedom of Information request, which cracks me up. Sometimes people will say, think I'm some kind of expert on FOIA, and I'm like, no, I'm really not very good at it at all. I've developed sources over the years, and of course, I've been covering these cases now. I'm almost 20 years now I've been writing about this case, especially in many other cases.
Since we last spoke, you've also uncovered new information about James Earl Ray, who was convicted of assassinating Dr. Martin Luther King in 1968 and who has subsequently died in prison. What's the development there?
There are some FBI documents as well as some Miami police documents that suggest the White Knights of the Ku Klux Klan played a role in the death of King, specifically trying to jam police radios that day that King was killed, April 4th, 1968. In addition to those particular documents, we also found out from FBI documents that word of a bounty, a reward, so to speak, by the White Knights of the Ku Klux Klan got into the cell where James Earl Ray was being held in Missouri back in 1967. So obviously before King was assassinated, and one of the inmates there told the FBI that Ray said to him he was going to kill King to get the bounty. One of the things that I'm trying to work on now is to get those documents that do exist, but they're redacted, and try to get those in some kind of unredacted form.
Do you ever write a story that may be a little murky, a little amorphous, even a little thin, with the expectation of drawing out yet more information, more sources, to flesh the narrative out still more?
Absolutely. I think when I was a young reporter, I thought I had to have the whole puzzle figured out. And as I've gotten to be hopefully a better reporter, I've learned that you can basically, if you have a piece, just like I have with the Martin Luther King case, you just kind of take them out there and see what comes up.
In what other ways is your technique evolving? You've got the advantage of digital technology.
Mm-hmm.
But let's say, unlike some carpetbagger Yankee reporter coming down to Mississippi,
that's right.
You've got some other old-fashioned advantages, like your accent, and you're willing to take Klansmen to barbecue. I mean, that's something.
And I'm white, too. That helps. I've taken Klansmen out for barbecue, for catfish. I believe I'm taking people out to eat. It's worked for me so far. I remember one time, this is pre-internet days, I was trying to track down this guy, one of the two policemen who gave Byron D. LeBeckwith an alibi in the Meg Rivers case. Meg Rivers was killed in Jackson in 1963, assassinated, and Beckwith did it and was later convicted. And so I was trying to find one of those guys that gave him the alibi. I called, he had a real unusual last name. His name was Hollis Kressel with one S. And so I just happened to have a old phone directory for Greenwood, Mississippi, which was where he had lived. And there were some of the same last names, so I figured, well, heck, you know, they've got to be related. And so I picked out a name that looked promising and asked for him, you know, put on my best Southern accent, you know, is Hollis there? And the guy answered and said, oh, no, you want my cousin. He lives over in Mabin. Here, let me give you the number. You got to love Southerners. It's
Now, that raises the question of the passage of time, not in terms of the death of perpetrators and witnesses, but in a kind of complacency setting in among those who were involved. Do they figure they've gotten away with it for four decades? Did they let their guard down?
I think you're absolutely correct. I mean, took Bobby Cherry out to barbecue. He ended up getting convicted. Edgar Ray Killen took him out for catfish, and he got convicted. And both those guys very much assume nothing would ever happen to him, and told me that. Killen told me that he would never be prosecuted. He's now able to, from the bowels of prison, say that statement proved not to be correct.
Is it your sense that, although the days of the white knights of the Ku Klux Klan are thankfully long behind us,
sure,
that there remains a kind of enduring sympathy for the entrenched racism of the period that is protecting men to this day?
There's a certain amount of sympathy for some of these guys. I know I've had people tell me, oh, Jerry, you know, why don't you leave these old guys alone and things like that. But, you know, really, they're just young killers who got old, you know. And there are still people out there who obviously would protect these guys. But I think that's slowly dying out, and it may have to do with this passage of time. Hopefully it has to do with maybe some people changing their minds or changing their hearts.
You have said that there's maybe a window of another 5 years in which people are going to be alive long enough or lucid long enough to put together a prosecution. But the newspaper business is dying pretty fast itself, and the Clarion Ledger is a Gannett paper. Gannett's stock price has tanked.
Yeah, plummeted.
And I'm just curious whether there's 5 years left in the Clarion Ledger to pay for the kind of single-minded coverage that you're contributing.
So far, so good. They've been totally supportive and continue to support me, and I think I'll be able to continue this for the next 5 years. I think journalism is one of the most noble professions in the world, and I just feel so fortunate to be a part of it.
I feel fortunate that you're part of it myself.
Thanks. I appreciate that.
Jerry Mitchell is an investigative reporter for the Clarion Ledger in Jackson, Mississippi.
We
We've devoted this hour to investigative journalism as practiced by real reporters. Obviously, most of us don't have firsthand experience in tracking down and writing up a scoop. What we do have is the movies. Filmmakers have long been fascinated with the idea of the ink-stained gumshoe. In the silent era, movies with titles like The Daring of Diana and The Final Extra treated journalism as an adventure, and it's no different in the modern age. Joe Saltzman is director of the Image of the Journalist in Popular Culture, or IJPC, at the University of Southern California Annenberg School for Communication. He's seen thousands of such movies, and he joins us now. Joe, welcome to On the Media.
Nice to be with you.
Let's start with a noirish take from 1948. It's called Call Northside 777.
Well, it's one of the few films that really shows how a reporter gets a story. Journalist was generally, the investigative journalist especially, was like a private detective or a man of action. In Call Northside 777, you have Jimmy Stewart playing reporter P.J. McNeil. He works for the Chicago Times, and the way it works is a cop killer has been in jail for 11 years, and the editor sees an ad that says there's a $5,000 reward for information leading to proving this man's innocent. And the editor says, go out and do this story. And the reporter says, no, he's a cop killer. I don't want to do this story. He says, no, do it. It looks interesting.
What do you make of it?
Well, I want to know why it's worth $5,000 to someone to find out who killed a cop 11 years ago.
Now, there's a sucker bait. Every grifter and mooch in town will be after that $5,000. They'll frame their brothers to get it.
Well, it wouldn't hurt to check it. You might get your name in the paper.
One of the great scenes in that film that shows a reporter really at work is he goes to the police station to get some information from his police contacts who say, get away from us. Why are you doing this story? This guy's a cop killer. Leave it alone. Leave it alone. They won't cooperate. So he's sitting in the police station. He gets on the phone and he calls a policeman that has the records he wants and just says, this is McNeil, I'll be down to look at it. Not saying he's a reporter, not saying he's not a reporter, but calling from within the police station.
Hey, I'm McNeil. I just phoned you from headquarters. You got that book on the WeCheck arrest?
Ma'am.
He goes there, he starts taking pictures of the arrest reports. Finally, the guy on duty gets a little bit suspicious and says, who the heck are you? And he says, I'm McNeil from the Times. He says, you can't look at this stuff.
This is confidential information.
This is public information, and I'm entitled to use it.
We've got our orders. You got a beef, you talk to the state's attorney's office.
That's a good idea. I think I will.
He pulls the arrest book away from the reporter, but by then the reporter has all the information. And it's that kind of thing throughout the film that gives you a sense of this is a reporter really doing the work of a reporter.
Frank Wiecheck is free. Free because of a mother's faith, the courage of a newspaper, and one reporter's refusal to accept defeat.
So as you said at the beginning, in the 40s, reporters were generally depicted as adventurers. They were basically cops with pens. But there was another kind of investigative journalism depicted in a film from the 40s. It was called Gentleman's Agreement, starring Gregory Peck. Basically, this reporter wants to show that antisemitism is alive and well in America.
Gregory Peck playing a non-Jewish reporter called Philip Green. The editor wants him to find out not the Holocaust kind of hatred of the Jews, but the small anti-Semitism which he thinks is alive in America. And so Green pretends he's a Jew.
All I got to do is say it. Nobody knows me around here. I can just say it. I can live it myself for 6 weeks, 8 weeks, 9 months, no matter how long it takes.
And in fact, the name of the article, I believe, is I Was Jewish for 8 weeks. He finds all kinds of this gentleman's agreement that we don't sell houses or rent houses to Jews. We don't rent them rooms in a hotel. And he sees all kinds of minor things like that, which is the true anti-Semitism in America, and it's revealed in the film.
Like that, good man, completely reliable, not given to overcharging and stringing visits out the way some do.
You mean the way some doctors do, or do you mean the way some Jewish doctors do?
I suppose you're right. I suppose some of us do it, too.
Was this film mostly reflective of undercover journalism? Is that what this special hook was?
Well, ever since the beginning of film, reporters were always going undercover. They were part of a mob. They go to prison to try to find the story. They'd fake insanity to go inside an asylum and get the story. Shock Corridor is one in which the man pretends he's insane so he can go in and find a killer and win a Pulitzer Prize and ends up at the film actually insane.
Crystal, You've got to listen to me. You've got to let me out of here, please. Call my paper, talk to Swanee. He'll tell you why I'm here.
Now, John, don't start that again.
Wilkes killed Sloan, I swear it. Get Wilkes, I can prove it.
I thought you killed him, John.
Doctor, I'm not nuts. I'm here for the paper. I'm a plant.
They would do all kinds of things like that, and they took their cue from real-life journalists like Nellie Bly, in which undercover journalism and deception was quite common. They would pretend they were somebody they weren't.
Let's skip ahead to the 70s, when lots of rather paranoid films were being made about investigative reporters. Was it just a paranoid decade?
Yeah, I think the Kennedy assassination and the thoughts of conspiracy did create a situation where the reporter, again, being a hero, was out to expose this conspiracy. So by 1974, you'd have something like the Parallax View, with Warren Beatty playing reporter Joseph Frady, I believe, in which he exposes the conspiracy, and to silence him, they kill him at the end of the film and blame him for a senator's assassination that the multi-corporation political conspiracy created, actually.
Another film from the decade is Capricorn One. What makes that one notable?
Yeah, I love that film because it's a conspiracy involving space. Capricorn 1 has a reporter who finds out that the first manned mission to Mars was faked, and he's always being damned for creating the news rather than covering it.
You think the way to get ahead is to come up with the scoop of the century. Woodward and Bernstein were good reporters. That's how they did it.
Look, when a reporter tells his assignment editor that he thinks he may be onto something that could be really big, the assignment editor is supposed to say, you got 48 hours, kids, and you better come up with something good or it's going to be your neck. That's what he's supposed to say. I saw it in a movie.
Of course, the movie he's referring to is All the President's Men, released in 1976 and starring Jason Robards as Ben Bradley. Also Robert Redford and Dustin Hoffman as Woodstein.
Go on home. Get a nice hot bath. Rest up 15 minutes. Then get your asses back in gear. Nothing's riding on this except the First Amendment of the Constitution, freedom of the press, and maybe the future of the country. Not that any of that matters.
There are some notable moments of dialogue in the film, obviously, mostly shouted out by the character of Ben Bradley in the Washington Post that relates to reporting.
God damn it, when is somebody going to go on the record in this story?
Then he uses language I can't use on NPR to tell them if they screw up again, they're in real trouble. There's a wonderful sequence in All the President's Men where the reporters, Woodward and Bernstein, played by Redford and Dustin Hoffman, are in the Library of Congress trying to get records of what materials the White House checked out. They're looking through pieces of paper. They're trying to find the story. And what the photographer does, the cameraman does, is zoom out over their heads. And to show the passage of time, they keep dissolving until we get higher and higher and higher. And I love that shot because it, in a very cinematic way, it shows the very difficult job most investigative reporters do, which is in libraries and public hall of public records. And this one scene really sums up the hard work investigative reporters do that you very seldom see in the movies.
Now, the movie The Insider is about TV journalism, and it stars Al Pacino as Lowell Bergman, who we spoke to at the top of the show. Bergman was a reporter for 60 Minutes in the 90s.
Well, The Insider is a great film because it's based on real life. It's based on the real case of 60 Minutes. Lowell Bergman gets a tobacco executive to reveal what the tobacco industry knew about cigarettes being addictive and harmful and how they actually deliberately work to increase their addictiveness. Bergman gets him to go on camera, which any journalist knows is very difficult to do, to get somebody, a whistleblower, to actually appear on camera. They kill the story, and Bergman is furious.
You pay me to go get guys like Wigand, to draw him out, to get him to trust us, to get him to go on television. I do. I deliver him. He sits, he talks. Is it newsworthy? Yes. Are we going to air it? Of course not.
Investigative reporters are the perfect hero in the movies because they really are surrogates for the moviegoer. They ask the questions the moviegoer wants to know about. They get the information the moviegoer wants to find out. They give you great narrative. They give you great exposition. They're the perfect movie hero, and that's why I think we've had so many films featuring investigative reporters.
Joe, thank you very much.
My pleasure. It's my favorite topic.
Joe Saltzman is director of The Image of the Journalist in Popular Culture, a project of the Norman Lear Center at the University of Southern California's Annenberg School for Communication.
Don't forget, Project OTM T-shirt is in full swing. We'll be taking entries for another week. Go to onthemedia.org to get details, and then take your shot at designing the first ever OTM T-shirt. Thanks, and good luck. That's it for this week's show. On the Media was produced by Megan Ryan, Jamie York, Mike Volo, Mark Phillips, and Nazanin Rafsanjani, and edited by Brooke. We had technical direction from Jennifer Munson and more engineering help from Zach Marsh. We also had help from Gina Gasper. Our webmaster is Amy Pearl.
Katya Rogers is our senior producer and John Keefe our executive producer. Bassist composer Ben Allison wrote our theme. This is On the Media from WNYC. I'm Brooke Gladstone.
And I'm Bob Garfield.
Support for On the Media comes from the Ford Foundation, the Jane Marcher Foundation, the Overbrook Foundation, and the listeners of WNYC Radio. This is NPR.
This is Ira Flatow, host of Science Friday. For over 30 years, the Science Friday team has been reporting high-quality science and technology news, making science fun for curious people by covering everything from the outer reaches of space to the rapidly changing world of AI to the tiniest microbes in our bodies. Audiences trust our show because they know we're driven by a mission to inform and serve listeners first and foremost with important news they won't get anywhere else. And our sponsors benefit from that halo effect. For more information on becoming a sponsor, visit sponsorship.wnyc.org.